Hello, 27th of the 2nd, 2020, episode 9. So, this again is going to be about quantum mechanics and consciousness. A kind of a recap of podcast 8, and then I'm going to discuss a few anticipated criticisms of the theory I presented in podcast 8. So a few things that I think people might complain about my theory, and how I refute those complaints. Let's see. So, just to recap, first of all, I explained the hard problem of consciousness. How are you conscious if everything that makes you is thought to be non-conscious? How do those things come together to create consciousness? I explained that that's logically impossible. That's like putting together a bunch of neutrons and expecting electric charge to emerge. It's never going to happen, no matter how complexly you arrange the neutrons. And believing that the basic stuff of our universe isn't conscious, which currently scientists take for granted, physicists take for granted, creates a discontinuity in consciousness, assuming that you agree that you are a conscious yourself, which I'm going to take for granted, because if someone insists there's no c that they're not conscious, then, well, I don't see any point in arguing with them, because. Anyway, that's a more philosophical point. Then I reinterpreted quantum mechanics, a few, not all of it, obviously, very far from all of quantum mechanics, but a few of the most famous experiments, using the new postulate where E equals C, where C is capital C for consciousness, and energy, E is energy. So all energy is not just energy, or it is energy, but it's also conscious. It is consciousness. And it's consciousness that takes on different forms as we observe in the universe around us. And so the Big Bang was a physical event, but also a conscious event. There was some conscious state involved with the Big Bang. There was, T equals zero. That's when the Big Bang happened. That was a physical event. It was also a conscious event. There was some conscious state associated with the energy of the Big Bang. We obviously can't possibly know what that conscious state was like because we are very different configurations of conscious energy than the Big Bang. Very, very different indeed. So someday we might be able to speculate on what that first conscious state was, but at the moment we can't. And when I do conscious cosmologies, I actually just assign, or I just assume any random conscious state. I assume that kind of in a similar way to a lot of Bible stories assuming the universe beginning in chaos. I just assume any that there's any random conscious state associated with the Big Bang. Then the universe evolved in the way that that scientists have observed it to have evolved. The evolution of the universe from the Big Bang with the generation of the basic particles and things, and then the generation of the elements. And obviously, every state, every physical state corresponds to also a conscious state or conscious experience. And there was the creation of individual particles, such as electrons, localized, isolatable formations of consciousness, such that you have an individual consciousness that's separate from mine. I have my individual consciousness. And on some very, very loose level, they're connected, because we are all emitting radiation. Every human is a black body emitting radiation, and all our radiation is on some level intertwined, but we're not consciously aware of this of these types of very what's the word, weak connections that we have between each other. All I mean to say is, if you're sitting next to someone, you are radiating electromagnetic energy, and so are they, and it will be somewhat intertwined with your radio, electromagnetic radiation will be intertwined with one another's, which will have some very, very slight effect on your physical state, and thus some very, very slight effect on your conscious state, but it's imperceptible, such that we can say quite reasonably that two people sitting next to each other are two separate consciousnesses. As in, that whatever conscious connection they have is so weak as to be imperceptible, which is basically saying that telepathy doesn't yet exist, such that there are separate conscious individual entities. The first of these entities were things were much more basic than humans, things like electrons, protons and neutrons, and then they combined to form atoms and then molecules, and eventually very, very complex configurations of molecules, such as humans, with much, much more complex, correspondingly much more complex conscious states. As in, a human has much more varied, much more widely varying set of conscious states available to it than something as simple as an electron. So this, you know, as we see with evolution on the planet, there's a tendency to greater and greater complexity. The human brain is the most complex thing that has ever existed on Earth. And as such, it's the most intelligent thing that exists on Earth. And it's the most perceptive and most conscious thing on Earth, or most self-conscious thing on Earth. Intelligence going with it being proportional to complexity, which is something that is already acknowledged by people who are trying to make AI. They acknowledge that it's a complexity, the number of different neurons and the number of connections they make, that intelligence is dependent on these numbers in some form or other. I'm not sure if it's a linear dependence or not. I haven't really studied those things. Okay. Yeah, so that solves the hard problem of consciousness, in that everything that, all the basic components that make you up are conscious themselves. So we don't have to think about any sort of emergent consciousness. Consciousness doesn't have to suddenly switch on. Everything in you has always been conscious since the beginning of time, because all energy is conscious, or is consciousness. And to every physical state, there's a corresponding conscious state. For example, you have some physical state at the moment. Your body and your brain, and it can be measured physically, the momentum and the mass and the velocity, all of these things, and the exact configuration of every atom in your body could all be measured scientifically. But that wouldn't have anything to say about consciousness, because, or your conscious state, because currently consciousness is being ignored in physics, as in it doesn't figure anywhere. But you know yourself that corresponding to your physical state at any given time, there's your conscious state. So at the moment, you have your physical state and the corresponding physical state. And as you think and think different things, it corresponds to different physical states in your brain. So you can watch someone think about one thing and it will light up one part of their brain in a particular way. Watch them think about something else, it will light up their brain in another way. And different parts of the brain correspond to different functions in terms of your conscious state. And this is all evolved in the way that evolutionists have described, and neurologists. Okay, so that solves the hard problem of consciousness. Then I reinterpreted a few quantum mechanical experiments, some of the most famous ones, assuming that energy is in fact consciousness, and that these microscopic entities, these quantum entities in these experiments, have some basic consciousness. Not a personality, not a sense of self, no sense of humor or name or any ability to reflect on themselves or their own existence, which is an exclusively human thing as far as we're concerned. As in, your dog doesn't reflect on its own existence, or a plant, but they still are conscious. To reflect on your own existence is requires extremely complex consciousness, such as is generated by the very complex configuration that is the human brain. Okay, so we have much more basic conscious entities, such as electrons, protons, neutrons, molecules, and these are individual conscious things that we assume very basic consciousness of, such as some limited perception of the local universe around them, and some ability to choose between different future states or alternative future states, such as choosing to be spin up or spin down when in a magnetic field. And then I explained how you could explain, you know, the Stern-Gerlach experiment by positing pain and pleasure, a pain or pain and pleasure principle. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be pain, it could just be pleasant and more pleasant. You know, a human will always choose more pleasant over pleasant. And we're made of the stuff of this universe, so it's very logical to assume that the more basic stuff will also choose more pleasant experiences over less pleasant experiences. So the electron chooses spin up or spin down because it aligns its spin with the magnetic field, which is obviously more pleasant than having it at an angle to the magnetic field. More pleasant or less painful, whichever. And you can use that, and I'll do this in another episode, you can use that very simple principle to begin with the most basic conscious entities in the universe and build up to humans eventually. Because as is obvious, all humans and all conscious life tries to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Okay, so I went through those experiments and explained them with the new postulate, E equals C. So all the energy in the Big Bang was also, along with all the physical properties it has, was also conscious. And with all those physical properties came conscious properties. And the universe has been evolving, has evolved the way it has by making conscious choices. And in fact, following the mathematical laws, or the physical laws of the universe, has actually been conscious choice of the universe. Not with any plan necessarily, it's just the way that it's behaved consciously. I'll dedicate a whole other episode to the nature of physical law and how consciousness affects and changes our conception, our philosophical conception of physical law. But I don't think this episode is the one to do it. But, I mean, to put it very briefly, physical laws, they're not actually laws. They're actually conscious conventions. But, that'll take and physical law is actually an illusion. But anyway, it's a very good approximation to the truth for doing objective physics. Then let me think, what was I going to say? Yeah. So then in these quantum mechanical experiments, you have these individual conscious entities making choices based on some limited perception of the universe around them. Just like you make choices between certain alternatives based on your perception, not of the whole universe, but of some of the universe around you. And I spoke a little bit about some of the laws of consciousness, such as consciousness being local. It's also a ranged phenomena. That is, it's range dependent, as in an electron in your brain has much more effect on your consciousness than an electron in the sun. Conscious perception is ranged. You're more conscious of things nearer to you. So we can start thinking about the physical laws of the scientific physical laws of consciousness. Because what I'm trying to do is, I know, or I don't know, I predict I'm going to be accused of woo-woo and things like that. But I'm trying to be very careful to stick with the scientific method, which is to come up with the most basic laws of consciousness, and that is just the most basic heuristic guidelines for which to treat it scientifically. And the first thing you need is the correct postulate, and that is that all energy is conscious, or is consciousness. And energy and matter not being conscious is the old postulate, which, and then they try and scientists try and come up with emergent theories of consciousness, which for decades and decades have proved totally unfruitful, which is evidence. So that's decades of negative results in evidence of my theory. So yeah, I reinterpreted a few quantum mechanical experiments. I explained why the maths doesn't need to be changed. So maybe now I'll just say a few words on the difference between microscopic and macroscopic. Why, you know, scientists always talk about the macroscopic realm and the microscopic realm, and the difference between the two. In the microscopic realm, we deal with atoms and molecules. And they behave differently than the macroscopic things like footballs and baseballs. And that now, based on my theory, we have a way of understanding that. And the essential difference between microscopic and macroscopic is that microscopic quantum mechanics deals with single individual conscious entities. So it deals with each experiment, you have one electron going through, for example, or one molecule going through. And one molecule is a group of basic protons, neutrons, and electrons merging into one conscious thing. The same way all the atoms in your body have merged into one conscious experience. The same thing happens in a molecule. But you have individual conscious entities in these experiments, such that when you do these experiments, the quantum mechanical experiments, you witness one entity choosing between alternatives. You witness one consciousness making choices for itself based on the constraints imposed upon it by the experimental apparatus in question. What happens in macroscopic experiments? You don't have one consciousness making choices. If you have, let's say, take a macroscopic crystal, for example. What is a crystal? A crystal is a construction made out of many, many individual atoms, all arranged in a in a pattern. The pattern in physics, the pattern is referred to as a crystal lattice. So you just it's a very regular, a crystal is a very regular thing. So the lattice could be, for example, imagine graph paper. When you're doing maths in school, you had graph paper, and all the lines cross one another. And where the lines cross, you know, at the corners of the little squares that your graph paper makes, at each point there, there'll be one atom making up this crystal. So that's how a crystal works. There's a lattice. Now, at each point of the lattice, there's a crystal. So when you have a macroscopic object like a crystal, it's not one individual conscious entity. It's many, a typical crystal will be many millions of atoms, all of which themselves are sufficiently separate from each other. They're not combined into a molecule. Like a molecule is a few atoms combined into one thing. It's just a small enough molecule. But a crystal lattice is sufficiently separate such that they're individual conscious entities joined by whatever forces happen to be joining them. So when you put a crystal in certain experiments, it's not one conscious entity choosing between alternatives. It's many, many conscious entities all behaving individually, as in they're all just vibrating around their own lattice points individually. And therefore, there's no guiding consciousness to make choices. So the best analogy to think of, I suppose, is again, because we're dealing with consciousness, we've got to make analogies to humans, because the only way a human knows consciousness is through human consciousness. So if everything is conscious, the only way we know, the only way we can talk about that consciousness is with analogy to our own consciousness, because that's the only consciousness you ever experience. And the only reason you know your dog, for example, is conscious is because by analogy to your own. You see it has eyes, you see it has ears, you can see it's hungry sometimes, you can see it's happy sometimes. But the only reason you know it's hungry is because you've been consciously experienced hunger yourself. And that's, as I said, that's because of one of the laws of consciousness of this universe, which is that consciousness is purely subjective, and you can only experience your own consciousness. So all other consciousness apart from your own has to be inferred, which is what I'm doing with quantum mechanics. So you imagine a human, let's imagine a human walking down a hill, for example. So it's got some there'll be some gravitational force kind of pulling it down the hill a little bit. But, you know, if it's not that steep, the person can control their speed and they can stop walking if they want, because their muscles are strong enough to oppose the gravitational force. They can move left or move right. And we can observe that person and see that that person is deciding their direction and their speed individually. So that's like one single quantum entity, one single electron. Then you can imagine 50 people all bound together somehow. Let's say they're all locked arms together. Let's say their arms are tied together and their ankles are all tied together. So now you have 50 humans, 50 individual consciousnesses, but they're all bound together. And now you can see that no single one of those conscious entities, no single one of those 50 people is choosing what happens, is choosing where exactly the whole mass is going to go, where exactly the whole group is going to go. No one person is able to decide, let's go left, let's go right. In fact, they'll have a great deal of trouble not just falling down the hill under the force of gravity, because they're 50 separate conscious entities bound together. And therefore, they can't make their own singular decisions. But they're bound together. And then you can imagine the whole group just rolling down the hill under the force of gravity, unable to oppose it, because they are many different conscious entities not working in concert together such that they can oppose the gravitational force. And that is like a massive object. A whole group of electrons, protons, and neutrons bound together by, chemical forces. Not chemical forces. Whatever forces are, I can't think of the top of my head. Whatever forces would be binding. Binding the electrons, protons, and neutrons together into a macroscopic object. That macroscopic object will just succumb to the basic force of gravity and will follow, and will just follow the path of gravity and you could use, Newton's theory of gravity to work it out, deterministic mathematics to work it out. So probabilistic quantum mechanics comes about when you isolate an individual conscious entity, which is what an electron is, or a neutron, or a single molecule, or a single atom is. So when you see, basically, when you see quantum behavior, what you're seeing is the behavior of a single conscious entity. So if you see a molecule that's small enough that it's exhibiting quantum behavior, you know that that molecule is one conscious entity, making its own choices between alternatives, as in it's collapsing the wave function for itself. Macroscopic entities are large numbers of individual conscious entities bound together, and thus in much less control of their physical state, and they wind up succumbing to forces like gravity and other forces, and they wind up behaving in the way described by Isaac Newton in deterministic mathematics. So when you have large numbers of entities bound together, then you can use Newtonian mechanics. An appropriate approximation is to use Newtonian mechanics. But if you strip one individual conscious entity away, one electron away, then when you do experiments, you'll observe quantum behavior. So quantum behavior is the behavior of individual conscious entities. And that's the real essential difference between macroscopic and microscopic. Okay. I wanted to say that. No, I suppose I want to defend myself against people saying this isn't science or it's not scientific. First of all, I did provide two testable hypotheses, the bat experiment and Schrodinger's conscious cat experiment, I call it. And I talked about those in episode 8, and you can see a description of them in my essays, which I'll link with this episode. So I put forward two testable hypotheses. They're very easy to test. Take bats and send them through a appropriately sized slit-like architecture, and they'll reproduce the interference pattern on a net behind the screen, behind those slits. And an interference pattern is the quintessential fingerprint trademark of quantum mechanics. So if we see conscious entities producing the interference pattern, it's suggestive that the electrons producing it are conscious as well. Now, of course, it's not exactly analogous. It's not exactly analogous at all, because a bat is a macroscopic object which will only ever go through one slit. An electron will actually become a wave and go through both slits as a wave. But my argument is that the electron becomes a wave of perception. It's using perception to is a conscious perception to perceive some of the universe local to it, and that wave of perception goes through the slits and interferes, creating the interference pattern, creating dark and light fringes in its perception, creating black spots in its perception, which where it never lands. And the bat, whilst it doesn't go through both slits, its wave of perception does go through both slits. And this could even happen. The electron could go through just one slit every time, but it could send forth a wave of perception and always go through just one slit. Anyway, I'm going to dedicate a whole podcast to whole episode to the observer effect and why the camera makes the interference pattern, destroys the interference pattern. But the bat does send its wave of perception through both slits, so they interfere, and as it comes through the slit, its perception will be disrupted by the interference pattern, and it will produce the same interference pattern. Obviously, this will have to be, you'll have to find a bat with that's has an appropriate size to the wavelength of sound that it uses to echo locate. But there are many different sized bats, so hopefully one bat has, and you can work that out mathematically based on the bat's size and the frequency it uses to echolocate. You can work out, it's very simple math, you can work out what size slits you'll need and what distance the screen will have to be such that interference of effects will show up in the bat's location as it goes through the slits. So hopefully, yeah, there's some bat of an appropriate size with reference to its with the frequency of sound it uses, such that it will reproduce the interference pattern. And then we'll see this quintessentially quantum mechanical phenomena, the interference pattern showing up, being reproduced by conscious entities, being which is very suggestive that the electrons that produce the interference pattern are also conscious in the way I've described. And I also believe there will be many other quantum mechanical experiments that can be that where analogies can be made between the behavior of certain quantum mechanical entities and the behavior of certain animals, conscious animals or conscious things. So I'm sure there'll be many more experiments along the same lines. And then the conscious cat experiment, to show that quantum processes are conscious in that they're susceptible to the consciousness of nearby conscious entities, such that the conventional probability is skewed in favor of the life form. Anyway, I explained that in the previous podcast. Again, very testable, very easy to do. Will take some refining, sure. I mean, I've only presented it as a Gedanken, because I'm not an experimental physicist. I'm a theoretical physicist. Experiments are not my, or actually doing experiments is not my thing at all. So, Given that there's no other theory, I mean, my theory is logical at least. It is quite revolutionary, as in you've got to come to terms with the fact that everything around you is conscious in some way. But then you are conscious yourself, and you're made of the same stuff, so it's not actually that surprising, really. And, like I'm putting my hand in this chair, it doesn't mean this chair is aware of me or has some sort of personality, not at all. It's just that it's made up of individual conscious entities that all do have some limited perception of their physical circumstances, like atoms on a lattice, a crystal lattice, which is what most material objects are inanimate, what would be known as inanimate objects, are just atoms and molecules in some sort of lattice arrangement, bound together. But each of the individual things will be itself conscious, but not in a kind of without personality, without a sense of self, as I keep reiterating. So it's not that wild. And you're conscious and you're made of the same stuff, and it actually makes sense of your conscious experience. So there's nothing really anti-scientific about it, and there's no woo-woo. I mean, the only thing that's woo-woo really is the fact that you're conscious, which is just inherently quite miraculous. I mean, there was a big bang and now you're here. That's, as Einstein says, there are two ways of viewing the universe. One is if nothing's a miraculous, and the other is as if everything's miraculous. And yeah, I mean, it is pretty miraculous to have come into conscious existence. But I'm just trying to give a logical explanation for it. There is no other logical explanation. The physicists that came up with quantum mechanics admitted that it didn't really make sense. None of them were happy with it. Einstein was almost offended by it. Niels Bohr, who came up with the Copenhagen interpretation, he didn't understand it either. He openly admitted he didn't understand it, but he said, well, this is just the way the universe is behaving. And the hard problem of consciousness is not going to be solved by emergent consciousness. It's just not going to happen. And there are decades of negative results to show that. Yeah, so I've done nothing anti-scientific. I followed the scientific method. I've just changed one postulate, just like Copernicus did. He changed one postulate and put the sun in the middle of the solar system. I've changed one postulate and I've said, oh, the Big Bang, all that energy was conscious. Until now, it was thought, oh, the Big Bang, all that energy wasn't conscious. So I've changed one simple postulate and then I've started doing science based off that. And the science that I can do based off that makes much more sense of you being conscious. And this is how science works. It always works by expansion, without deforming what was previously there. So I deform nothing of what was previously there. I still accept that Newtonian mechanics is a great approximation when you're dealing with large numbers of conscious entities bound together, so, which is to say, macroscopic objects. It's still a great approximation. I've just expanded physics to include consciousness. So all physics to date is my physics, but with consciousness set to zero. And all physics is just an expansion where the old physics is realized as an approximation to the new physics. So I'm following very, very much following the scientific method in terms of scientific revolutions. Let's see. Oh yeah, and then in podcast 6 or 7, I talked about what's his name? Sam Harris. He talks about free will. Oh yeah, and just to say what I was saying, finish what I was saying. Yeah, there is no other theory. There's no competing theory. Like I have no competition because there's no theory that makes sense of consciousness. You can try and find it. Try and find a theory of consciousness that explains how the non-conscious things suddenly give rise to consciousness. It's just not there. And I've looked. And Roger Penrose, who is definitely the expert, he admits that the theory is not there. On Joe, you can go and watch him on Joe Rogan. He's a genius and a great mathematician and a great physicist. Dedicated his whole life to consciousness. I mean, he did a lot of work with Stephen Hawking as well, black holes and things. But for the most part, he's worked on consciousness, I think. Well, whatever. He's done a lot of work on consciousness. He wrote The Emperor's New Mind. and another book I forget the name of. And he admits there's no theory. He's looking for it in microtubules. Somehow the consciousness is going to suddenly be found somehow in the microtubules. Well, I agree, consciousness is in the microtubules, it's also in the neurons, it's also in the electrons, the protons, and the energy, because it's fundamental. And if probabilism can be fundamental, as in probabilism in traditional quantum mechanics has no physical basis, that is to say, the electron doesn't flip a coin, it just behaves like that, then consciousness can just as much be inherent or fundamental. And you can tell that consciousness is inherent in the physical stuff of this universe because you're made of the physical stuff of this universe. And inherent within your configuration is your conscious experience. And if you fuck with your configuration, you fuck with your conscious experience. That is to say, if I start damaging your frontal lobes, your conscious experience will be destroyed. Okay. So there is no competing theory. But yeah, I guess I have this fear that I'll be somehow ridiculed, or this will be called woo-woo, even though I'm very strictly following the scientific method. As I said yesterday, there's no strange things like, oh, your brain is an antenna for picking up consciousness. No, your brain is the consciousness. It's right there, local. Just like, and consciousness has a lot of the features that other physical phenomena of our universe has, as in it's ranged. Just like gravity is ranged, a gravitational force decreases with distance, so does conscious influence. It's local. Gravity is local. Just like consciousness. It's local to the stuff, you know, your consciousness is local to your physical configuration. Damn, some people have arrived here. Where will I go? They're back already. I'll go in here. Then, door. Then, yeah, so there's nothing woo-woo or crazy about this. And you don't have to invoke a god or any special initial configuration of the universe, nothing like that. It's just expanding the current physical picture to include consciousness, which obviously does exist because you're conscious. So that's why I'm kind of repeating myself a lot, because I want to be very, very clear, because I've been very careful to follow the scientific method. Oh yeah. And so what I didn't mention yesterday is, so a few words on free will, and then I think I'm finished. So I said that consciousness has some basic characteristics, or what's the word? Properties or powers. So I was talking about electrons yesterday, and I said they have some perception of the local universe, as well as some ability to make choices. And these choices are free will choices. So my theory is a theory of free will. So scientists have long believed that we don't have free will because they've been thinking deterministically, because they've been thinking in the Newtonian way. Quantum mechanics comes along and says Newtonian physics doesn't work for these experiments. And now I'm coming along and saying what does work for these experiments is free will, conscious choice. And then Newtonian mechanics is an approximation that I explained earlier. So in my theory, you do have free will. It's just limited free will. You don't have total and complete free will. But an electron, for example, has the free will to choose between spin up and spin down. A particular particle has the free will to choose whether it will tunnel through a potential barrier or not tunnel through a potential barrier. And it has the free will to choose exactly when it will tunnel through. And an electron going through a slit can choose where exactly it will land. Has the free will to choose where exactly it will land on the screen behind the slit. Just like, I don't know, for example, you come to a field, you want to sit down, you can choose whereabouts in the field to sit down. That's like an electron choosing where to land on the screen. So, my theory postulates inherent, intrinsic, fundamental free will. It's just limited. You don't have free will to do anything you want. You don't have free will to fly. The free will is limited by the universe around you, which imposes constraints that can limit your choices. For example, at the moment you have free will to choose to clap your hands, but if I put you in a straitjacket, then the universe around you has constrained you to some extent such that you no longer have that choice. And that's what physical experiments, scientific experiments are about. Scientific experiments correspond to constraints imposed on a system. So then you'd be constrained and you wouldn't be able to clap your hands anymore. So your free will would be somewhat more limited. And how many choices and alternatives you have available to you depend on the universe around you as well as your physical configuration, which obviously your physical configuration is what creates your conscious state and your imagination and your ability to choose, your ability to imagine future states and then to choose between them. So there is actually inherent free will in the universe. Now, Sam Harris was on Joe Rogan, and he put forward an argument that, as far as he was concerned, proves that you don't have free will. So obviously I need to contend with that argument. So he said that scientists can give you some choice, let's say between left or right, and then they observe your brain, and then they ask you to say exactly when you have to choose between left or right, and you have to say at what moment you choose between left or right. So you have to say, you have to tell the experimenter when exactly you make the choice. And the experimenter watching your brain is able to say which you will choose before you make the choice. Whether you'll choose left or right before you make the choice. So Sam Harris is trying to say, oh, that means that the choice is made before you by some sort of chemical reaction. And then you just experience making a choice, but you didn't really make a choice. And he observed, because they observe your brain and they see you, your brain, something in your brain, they observe what's happening in your brain, and they see you choosing left or choosing right based on what they see in the brain, and that happens before you tell the experimenter that you've decided. Well, here's the thing, here's my explanation of that and how we can reconcile free will with that experiment. What's the point that Sam Harris is missing is that experiment involves reflection. It involves self-reflection. So that is, the person has to make a choice, and they're in a scientific setting where they've been asked to watch themselves and tell when they've made that choice. Now, that's not a normal way of making a choice. Normally, you're not watching yourself. If you're going to decide between Coke and Pepsi, you're not normally watching yourself saying, well, when am I going to make this choice exactly? Have I made the choice yet? Have I made the choice yet? No, you don't do that. You just choose. So what? And that's it. And I'm saying that is a free will choice. So what happens in this experiment is, the person actually does make the choice, and when they make the choice, Sam Harris sees them, or the experimenter sees them in the brain scan making the choice. That's what the experimenter observes. The experimenter observes the real choice. Then it takes a few moments of self-reflection, because the patient has to, in this case, it's a strange scenario. The patient has to be watching themselves, and they have to be questioning themselves: Have I made the choice? Have I made the choice? And they only decide, have I made the choice, sometime after they've actually made the choice, because they're reflecting on themselves. And it's this self-reflection that causes the slight delay. But what Sam Harris is actually witnessing, or the experimenter is actually witnessing in the brain scans, is the person making a free will choice. Then there is some delay as the person reflects and asks themselves, which is really a verbal thing, and is a level above the natural spontaneous choice, and comes after. The self-reflection takes some time after the actual choice. But what this experimenter is actually witnessing is the actual free will choice. It's just, there's a delay because the person is in an experimental setting where they have to do this self-reflection thing that takes some time. They have to reflect on themselves, observe themselves making the choice, and decide, oh, now I've made the choice, and then they tell the experimenter. And that's what creates the delay that Sam Harris was claiming proved free will wasn't real. But actually, free will is real, and I've just put forward a scientific theory of free will and consciousness that explains quantum mechanics in a satisfactory, logical way, and also solves the hard problem of consciousness. And also, it makes sense of your everyday life. Because every day of your life, you're conscious, and every day of your life, you make choices, all the time. And every day of your life, they don't feel like determined choices. You feel like you have some period of uncertainty. You know, someone says Coke or Pepsi, you have some period of uncertainty, which of course has already been described in quantum mechanics, where the consciousness imaginatively weighs up the two future possibilities and then decides between them. And that's why we have the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. You also have this uncertainty principle in your everyday life, as in it just takes some time of uncertainty before you decide to choose, or actually choose and collapse the wave function in whatever way, depending on the choice. But every single day of your entire life, you felt like you're conscious and you felt like you have free will, and that you make free-willed choices between different alternatives. Now, you don't have complete free will. It's often constrained by the universe around you. You're not omnipotent. So the choices that you can make are dependent on your own intelligence. That is to say, your conscious configuration of your brain, etc. Based on your own intelligence and thus your imagination, and based on the universe around you. The universe around you can, it generates many constraints on your ability to choose between different alternatives, and can rule out certain alternatives sometimes, as I explained with the hand clapping thing. But as I say, this you know, there's nothing anti-scientific about this theory. It's just an expansion of science, and yeah, it is revolutionary compared to conventional physics, but I mean, there just is no current scientific understanding of physics, of consciousness rather, in physics. So this is definitely the way to start treating consciousness in science. And as I mentioned earlier, there was already one concession has been made to this in modern science. There's already been one concession made to what I'm talking about. There's already been one concession made to one of my laws. Again, check out my essay where I present the six laws. It should be linked. So one of those laws is the law of solipsism, or the law of privacy, which states that the only consciousness you can ever observe is your own. All of the consciousness has to be inferred. And the scientific establishment has already made a concession to this law in the Turing test, where it's accepted by the scientific establishment that to decide if an AI is actually conscious and intelligent, someone has to just talk to it and just come up with this and just decide subjectively, oh yeah, it's conscious and it's intelligent. That's because we can't actually objectively measure or see consciousness, as I explained in the podcast yesterday. Okay, so I just wanted to, yeah, preemptively defend against a few criticisms that I predict I'll face. But yeah, it definitely requires an open mind. So yeah, based on Copernicus, I figure that I'm going to meet with hostility from the scientific establishment, because it's such a new way of thinking about things, even though it's simple and logical. But, hopefully I'm talking to, obviously young people are just generally more open to new ideas. So hopefully I'm talking to young people who have some idea, who hopefully aren't in the scientific establishment, but who have an open mind and some idea of these things. Like, ideally, I'd love to, put this to Joe Rogan or people that listen to Joe Rogan, because he's not in the scientific establishment, but he doesn't know a lot about science, and he knows the basics about quantum mechanics. And he's had people on his show telling them, consciousness is a mystery, it's not understood, science doesn't know how to understand it. And I've just put forward a very simple and logical theory that does explain a lot of it. So hopefully I'm talking to people like that, and you might hopefully I've been able to explain myself clearly enough so that you might see that this is at the very least a competing theory that deserves some attention. I do predict that I'll be they'll be met with a solid hostility from the establishment, but that's very normal as well. Okay, I think I said most everything I wanted to say. Yeah, and I wanted to keep this episode short. So, yeah, that's it. Yeah, give the ideas some thought. You can even, if you do know quantum mechanics, you can go through other experiments where there are that involve collapses of the wave functions, and you can even imagine for yourself what might be the conscious processes taking place here. It's a very interesting way of thinking about these things. But yeah, I think I gave a reasonably good explanation of the difference between microscopic and macroscopic. And yeah, this I believe is definitely the right way to treat quantum mechanics and consciousness. Okay, that's enough. May all beings be blessed by the three jewels. May the planet be at peace. May the earth stay beautiful. May all beings be happy. May all have good fortune. Amen.